Have you ever been betrayed by someone you once deeply respected? Someone you trusted? Well, you're not alone. And today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll recounts one of the saddest stories in the Bible, when a king sabotaged one of his committed warriors. While on the battlefield, David betrayed Uriah, provoking a sequence of attempted cover-ups before the truth was ultimately exposed. By rehearsing this story, our goal is to gain practical instruction on how to cultivate a clear conscience. Chuck titled his message, "The Integrity of a Loyal Husband."
Today we're looking at one of the saddest chapters in all the Bible. It's the story of one of our heroes, and a man he killed. And the details of that still surprise you when you have such a high respect, as all of us do, for the psalmist David. But he was caught in the trap of his own guilt and unwilling to confess his wrong. He had an innocent man killed to cover his own tracks. I'm referring to 2 Samuel 11. If you've not yet turned, please do so. I'll be reading from the New Living Translation, maybe a little different from the version you use, but you'll follow along. You'll see the similarity. I'll be reading the first 17 verses of 2 Samuel 11. What I'm calling the integrity of a loyal husband could easily be a loyal warrior, Uriah. In the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. They destroyed the Ammonite army and laid siege to the city of Rabbah. However, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Late one afternoon, after his midday rest, David got out of bed and was walking on the roof of the palace. As he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told, "She is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. The end of the verse, "Then she returned home." Later, when Bathsheba discovered that she was pregnant, she sent David a message saying, "I'm pregnant." Then David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." So Joab sent him to David. When Uriah arrived, David asked him how Joab and the army were getting along and how the war was progressing. Then he told Uriah, "Go on home and relax." David even sent a gift to Uriah after he had left the palace. But Uriah didn't go home. He slept that night at the palace entrance with the king's palace guard. When David heard that Uriah had not gone home, he summoned him and asked, "What's the matter? Why didn't you go home last night after being away for so long?" Uriah replied, "The ark and the armies of Israel and Judah are living in tents, and Joab and my master's men are camping in the open fields. How could I go home to wine and dine and sleep with my wife? I swear that I would never do such a thing." "Well, stay here today," David told him, "and tomorrow you may return to the army." So Uriah stayed in Jerusalem that day and the next, David invited him to dinner and got him drunk. But even then, he couldn't get Uriah to go home to his wife. Again, he slept at the palace entrance with the king's palace guard. So, the next morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and gave it to Uriah to deliver. The letter instructed Joab, "Station Uriah on the front lines where the battle is fiercest. Then pull back so that he will be killed." So Joab assigned Uriah to a spot close to the city wall where he knew the enemy's strongest men were fighting. When the enemy soldiers came out of the city to fight, Uriah the Hittite was killed along with several other Israelite soldiers.
You're listening to Insight for Living. To search the scriptures with Chuck Swindoll, be sure to download his Searching the Scriptures studies by going to insightworld.org/studies. Chuck titled his message, "The Integrity of a Loyal Husband."
Though he is a stranger to us, he was certainly no stranger to the people of Israel. As a matter of fact, his name, I'm convinced, was known all across the land. I'm referring to Uriah the Hittite, not David the king. Uriah. Isn't it interesting that we can grow up as Christians, become somewhat familiar with the Bible, and go past significant individuals and sort of relegate them to a minor role that sort of forgotten and not that worthy of remembrance. On the contrary, I believe Uriah was a household name, certainly within the ranks of the Israeli army, and I believe among the people of Israel. Let's begin not in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel, but chapter 23. Turn there. Returning to the end of David's life, where he sort of wraps up a number of things, including those who meant so much to him in battle. At verse 8, he does what he's not done before. He names his mightiest warriors, you will notice. These are the names of David's mightiest warriors. I'd venture to say that you could name none of them. I admit I wouldn't have known or remembered. First is Yashobim the Hagonite. See what I'm saying? The Hakbonite, I should say. Yashobim. He just killed 800 soldiers in one battle with a spear. Other than that, it was just a day at the office. That's Yashobim. He's the number one in the list of these mighty men. The second is named for us, and the third, and the fourth, and all the way down to the end of the chapter. Go with me to the end. We come to this 38th verse. Ira from Jatir, Gareb from Jatir, Uriah the Hittite. There were 37 in all. Did you realize that Uriah the Hittite was among the elite corps in the Israeli army? We would say one of the Medal of Honor winners, one of the fiercest of the warriors, well known for his heroic and courageous work on the battlefield. Well respected among his peers. And this 37 in this elite corps, not unlike our SEALs or those special forces, This elite body could have been the original band of brothers. They had each other's back. No doubt a chest full of medals, if they gave such back in those days, and well respected among the nation. Interesting that Uriah the Hittite was an Israeli soldier. Not an Israeli, but a Hittite. So he was once among the God-worshipping idolaters of the Hittites. And his name, no doubt, was not Uriah, which means Yahweh is my light, or the Lord is my light. He adopted that name when he converted to Judaism, became a part of his now beloved nation, which he protects with his life and, if necessary, his death. This is quite a man. He may have been Hittite in his birth and blood, but he was Israeli in his heart. It must have been an interesting engagement, if they had such in those ancient days, when his eyes fell upon the beautiful daughter of Eliam. We're never told how they met or how long they knew one another before there was talk of a wedding. I'm sure the rabbi of Bathsheba's community felt it was an honor to officiate at the wedding of a hero like Uriah and a beauty like Bathsheba. I've had hundreds of weddings in my experience as a minister, none that I prize more than military weddings. If you've ever been to one where officers meet and that band of brothers have come together and they've worn their swords, and when it's time for leaving the ceremony, they flash those swords and they form a tunnel and you walk beneath the swords on the way out. Still gives me a chill. I love military weddings. And I think Uriah's must have been like that. As he and Bathsheba, she's on his arm, what a couple they were. They needed a place to live. And even though we have no record of their searching for a house, how wonderful it was when the bride and groom were offered a little place in the shadow of the royal palace. Perfect. Uriah admired no one more than the one who occupied that palace. It was his king whom he defended at any cost. Uriah and Bathsheba nestled into that little home to begin their honeymoon together and hope for a wonderful series of springtime days together as they would enjoy the pleasures of marriage and the beginning of life as a couple. It must have been wonderful. The beautiful flowers of Israel are in bloom. The cool breezes from the Mediterranean even reach up as far as the elevation of Jerusalem. And one day there's a knock at the door and Uriah reads his orders that come from the king. He's ordered into battle, of all things. That treacherous, implacable enemy, the Ammonites, are at it again. They're trying to take Rabbah, the city above them. And the army is needed. And that means those 37, or at least Uriah among the 37, were called into duty, and his orders were cut, and there's no arguing and no disagreement. And Bathsheba must have broken into tears, thinking her groom would leave, and who knows what he would face. The possibility of being killed in battle was a very real thing, as every bride of any soldier or marine or sailor knows. And he mounts up, and after a long embrace and many kisses and quiet farewells, he makes his way with his outfit up to Rabbah. What's interesting is when he gets there, he doesn't see the king. It was common in ancient days for the king to lead the troops in battle. It's not like that at all now. The highest ranking general, or certainly the commander in chief, is never on the front lines, always protected. But in those days, the king led the fight. But in this day, it's Joab. Joab's been appointed the field commander. He will lead the battle at Rabbah. Uriah learns of that, and whoever it may be, he will certainly cooperate with the plan because Joab is appointed by his king. So Uriah would answer to Joab as the battle begins. All of a sudden, we're moved in just a single verse back to Jerusalem, to the bedchamber of David, who is taking a nap while his soldiers are fighting. We're never told why. Why didn't he go into battle? Why did he hang back at the palace? For whatever reason, it was late in the afternoon, after he had enjoyed a midday rest, that he stretches himself sitting on the side of his bed, stands up. It must have been hot in the room, so he turns and decides to walk out where there might be a cooler breeze on the roof of the palace. When he does, he hears the splashing of water. David's never taken the time to observe who his neighbors are. Suddenly, he's interested in one of them. He sees the body of a beautiful naked woman bathing. You know, preachers have down through the years chosen to make Bathsheba a part of this whole illicit affair, but I find it hard to do that. I think she may have normally bathed here. She didn't see the king, though he saw her, and he inquired who she was. He didn't even know the name of the neighbor. Someone said to him, "She is the daughter of Eliam, the wife of one of the 37, the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Doesn't faze David. He says to the servant, "Get her for me." At this point, lust takes over. I pause not to preach here, but just to remind all of us that lust has a way of, well, as the Proverbs puts it, binding us and grinding at us and blinding us. Blinded by lust, forgetting that he has other women already, his wives in the palace. He wants another one. Forgetting who he is and forgetting the respect the nation has for him. I mean, it's the city of David. It's the Star of David on the flag. It's David's royal palace. But right now, it's David who wants a woman. Bring her to me. She comes. The two of them lie together. Adultery is committed, and she quickly is on her way. I think David thought little of it by now. His guilt has blinded him to even a concern about what has happened until he gets word from her that changes everything. "I am pregnant." Now, since we're reading the story and hearing it, sitting in this place filled with lights and surrounded by fellow believers, it's a good place to just think clearly, which David was not doing. When you are consumed now by guilt, as Alexander White puts it, soaked to his eyes in guilt, your mind plays tricks on you. And he commits the second sin in all of time, The first was the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden when they took of the tree. The second was their hiding. Rather than admitting to God they had eaten of the forbidden fruit, they hid and they covered up. Interesting words appear in the Genesis account in chapter 3. After they had sinned, they knew suddenly that they were naked. They'd been naked all along, but when sin came, they, for the first time, were self-conscious, self-aware. And they covered up as if they could hide from God or cover their sin. But David doesn't think of any of that. He thinks of one thing. I've got to get Uriah in bed with his wife, whatever it takes. Uriah is on the battlefront, remember? A messenger hands him a message. You are to return to meet with the king in the royal palace. Remember, Uriah has never read 2 Samuel 11, okay? It's easy to forget that. We're privy to information that even the characters on the page are not. He must have thought, what an honor to pull me from battle. What a privilege is mine for my king to ask an audience with me. Without hesitation, Uriah takes the message and does exactly as it says. I can only picture it. He comes off his mount as he reaches the steps of the palace. He walks up. That palace guard must have stood at ramrod attention, snapped a salute. He returns it, walks in, and is escorted back to the private chamber of David the king. As he enters, everyone else in the room leaves. The door closes, and here is that unbelievable moment. He, face to face with the king of Israel. His heart must have been in his throat. What an honor. And he waits to hear what the king will say. Look at the words. Listen to the hypocrite. When Uriah arrived, verse 7, David asked him, how's Joab? And how's the battle progressing? He didn't care about either one. He wanted Uriah home with his wife. But Uriah must have thought this is going to lead to something far more important. They're fine. The battle is going well, my king. Great. Verse 8, go on home, Uriah. Rest. Rest? Go home? Surely there's more in David's mind than this. Why, as a matter of fact, for the first time in his entire life, he doesn't obey an order. We read specifically, Uriah didn't go home, verse 9. That night he slept with the palace entrance guards at the king's palace. This top elite soldier rolls up a garment and makes it his pillow and sleeps on the floor right there in the palace. Listen to the integrity. He is speaking to the king of Israel. I could not do that. The ark, the armies of Israel and Judah are living in tents. Joab and your men are camping in the open fields. How could I go home to wine and dine and sleep with my wife? I swear I would never do such a thing.
We're witnessing David, a man we often celebrate as a God-fearing leader, at one of his lowest moments. And if at all possible, please keep listening, because Chuck Swindoll will share this unfolding story tomorrow and again on Thursday. This is Insight for Living, and we're talking about the integrity of a loyal husband. To learn more about this ministry, please visit us online at insightworld.org. Well, David's tragic compromise is familiar to most of us, but I'm guessing that you've heard details and nuances to his story that are brand new to you. Chuck has a way of presenting the biblical record in a manner that helps us relate to each character. We see our own weaknesses in theirs, and the natural outcome is that we want to apply the wisdom of God's Word to our relationships so that we don't make the same mistakes. As a next step, we're recommending that you read one of the many biographies Chuck has written. For instance, he's written an entire book on David and one on Joseph, another biblical hero as well. It's called Joseph, A Man of Integrity and Forgiveness. Joseph rose from the pit of prison to the pinnacle of power. And along the way, Joseph walked with God and held on to his integrity with each step. So let God show you, through Joseph, how to trust him during the challenges of this new year. Again, Chuck's biography on Joseph is titled Joseph, A Man of Integrity and Forgiveness. To purchase a copy, call us. If you're listening in the United States, dial 1-800-772-8888 or go to insight.org/offer. You often hear me say that Insight for Living is made possible not through the purchase of books and other resources, but through the voluntary donations of friends like you. We rely on your support to make these daily Bible studies with Chuck possible. To give a gift today, call us. If you're listening in the United States, dial 1-800-772-8888 or give online at insight.org/donate. Join us when Chuck Swindoll again describes the integrity of a loyal husband, Wednesday on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, The Integrity of a Loyal Husband, was copyrighted in 2021 and 2022, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2022 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.